Hal Anderson Afternoons, the podcast.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. U of M Prof. Brian Peeler on the crisis in the Middle East. Counselor Matt Allard on this request for proposals on transit security. And Dr. Cyrus Dirksen on the $70 million Lotto Max jackpot. Please rate the podcast. Please subscribe to the podcast. And now, the podcast. Joining us on the phone from the University of Manitoba, Brian Peeler, a prof in political studies. Brian, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Hal. Thanks for having me on today.
Thank you for doing this. Yeah, we talked a bit about this last half hour. Your initial reaction to where we're at today?
It's hard to tell where we are today. I mean, my understanding is that the what would be equivalent to the National Security Council in the U.S. in Iran was meeting today, and I guess my understanding is the first time the Supreme Leader has actually met with this group in years. So we're just waiting to see what the Iranian response is going to be.
Any idea what that might be?
Well, I've seen lots of people talking about how this, could lead to a major escalation of tensions in the Middle East. And I think Iran will probably carefully calibrate how they respond to this. They don't want to provoke further U.S. response, and particularly in Iran. But it also does need to save face and so it's not obvious what they might do next.
And what do you, we were talking a bit about Trump last half hour too, and some things that he said about Barack Obama back in 2011, starting a war, worried about how he might do in the election. I don't want to get into that. There's obviously politics at play here,
sure.
But this was a very bad guy, and they obviously had an opportunity to go after him, to get him. And they did that. Now, he didn't consult with Congress and he didn't talk to allies. Should we be reading much into that, or was this sort of a necessary action?
Well, I do think it was a necessary action. I mean, Iran recently, they've shot down U.S. drones. They've seized oil tankers in the Strait of Hormuz. They bombed Saudi oil infrastructure, and it was the Iranian-backed militia that led the attack on the U.S. embassy in Iraq a couple of days ago. Soleimani was part of that. So the U.S. did need to do something. So I'm not so much worried about that, but the not consulting allies may be a problem, because remember now that Canada is now in charge of the NATO mission in Iraq, which is headquartered in Baghdad. And if I remember correctly, we have approximately 850 or so troops there at the moment. So we could be a target as a type of Iranian response to what has been done.
Yeah, and that's what I was going to ask you. My next question was going to be, what does this mean to us? I guess potentially it could mean higher gas prices. It could mean an attack on Canadian troops there. We don't know what to expect at this point,
no,
do we?
Exactly. And I think that's what I would be most worried about, is what could possibly happen to other troops, our troops in the region. Like I said, the Iranian regime is probably not going to engage in a sort of tit-for-tat response, like go after someone as high up in the U.S. military as he was in the Iranian military. But what they're more likely to do is we'll see more sort of attacks like we've seen previously, like I mentioned about the drone and seizing of oil tankers. What I would expect is possibly to see more of those sort of low-level actions more often.
Yeah,
but who knows? I mean, this Soleimani was an important leader in the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, and I mean, we can't be certain what could happen next.
Yeah, Trump is an interesting president because he doesn't seem terribly concerned. This is just how it seems to me. At times, he doesn't seem terribly concerned about consequences, where I think other presidents in the past have maybe said, well, you know, they're a little more cautious. Trump seems to make up his mind and just do it.
Yeah, which apparently, I mean, some of the reports I saw last night were that this even surprised people in the U.S. Defense Department. And that is worrisome that they weren't expecting this, because we need to sort of think through the consequences of what could happen next. And given the, you know, the people that are around President Trump and his advisors, I'm not so sure that there's a national security apparatus in place that I would trust to deal with what could come next from Iran.
Yeah, it's not a very deep bench there in the Trump administration when it comes to foreign relations, is it?
No.
Yeah. Some people are saying, you know, this is history repeating itself going back to 1979. Do you think we'll see retaliation of some point and then things will sort of normalize again? Or, you know, as I said earlier, and I realize social media is what it is, but there are people, I think this morning the hashtag World War III was trending number one. So, what level of concern are you at, Brian?
Yeah, I'm not worried. So much worried about that. I mean, the Iranian regime wants to preserve itself. So like I said earlier, it's not going to want to, want to provoke a U.S. response on Iranian soil. And that what we'd see is more of these sort of attacks we've seen in the past just stepped up. But that said, I mean, I believe in the next few days, I mean, the Iranians may step, you know, as a response to this, may step up their nuclear program. And then we're not sure how the rest of the world may respond to that.
Yeah. Yeah, there's certainly a lot to be concerned about in that part of the world. And yet this has been going on for decades, well, hundreds of years, really, hasn't it?
More or less, yeah.
We see something like this and we get concerned, as I think we should, but then this sort of stuff has been going on for so long in that part of the world, and I wonder, you know, do we really have any control or ability to influence things there? Should we be doing that, trying to play a role? When I say we, I mean the U.S. primarily, but the West, you know, should the West even be bothering with the Mideast?
We do have national interests here, like I said, with respect to, I mean, we want to make sure that people who are living in Iraq are safe. We want to make sure our soldiers who are there are safe. So I do think we do have an interest here. And, I think that's, you know, we want to make sure that everyone who is, you know, in particular, our troops are safe there.
Yeah. Well, let's hope they are. And let's hope that if we do see retaliation from the Iranians, it won't involve our Canadian troops there in Baghdad and in Iraq. Brian, thanks a lot for this. I really appreciate it. I'm sure we'll talk again. I don't think this is going to be over anytime soon.
You're very welcome, Hal. Have a nice weekend.
You as well. Brian Peeler, professor of political studies at the University of Manitoba. Joining us on the phone now, second time this week, Matt Allard, the counselor for St. Boniface. Matt, Happy New Year. It's officially 2020. All the best.
Thank you. Happy New Year to you, too. Hey, can I have that $70 million so that we can cancel all the potential cuts to the transit budget?
Well, as I was saying that, I was thinking, you know, $70 million probably would come in pretty handy down at City Hall, eh?
Yeah. Well, it would cancel the cuts and it'd give us an extra $20 million to do something else with. So that would be amazing if you could line that up.
What would you do? So if we took care of the potential cuts and you had $20 million left over, what would you, Matt Allard, spend that $20 million on?
Oh my goodness, that is such a good question. Can I think about it?
You started this, Matt. Yes.
I started it. That's true.
No, that's
true.
Okay.
You know,
yeah.
Like, if you look at my ward in St. Boniface, there's a lot of things that are on the chopping block right now. If we can't find ways to finance it, pool closures, arena closures. If I could cancel all that, I'd love to be able to do that.
Yeah, it'd be nice if we could do that. I want to talk to you today about this RFP, Request for Proposals for Transit Security. Tell me about this.
Yeah, so this has been a long time coming. So the City of Winnipeg established an advisory committee called the Transit Advisory Committee, and that has representation from the Winnipeg Police, from WAPSO, which represents the inspectors that are currently doing the security work on buses, the Amalgamated Transit Union, Functional Transit, and others. And so anyway, this is the culmination of work of that committee that comes with a unanimous recommendation from them on the terms of reference to this RFP. And it's basically to help us sort out what the security should look like on Winnipeg Transit, essentially.
And has the committee come up with any ideas, or are you guys wide open?
Well, I guess when we first made the decision, and it was a split decision with a transit advisory committee to hire additional point inspectors. So basically expanding the force of the people that we have that are sort of boots on the ground, eyes on the street. When things get escalate, though, they still have to phone the Winnipeg Police and ask them to intervene. So other jurisdictions have some have full-fledged police officers, some have private security, and some have inspectors like Winnipeg. But some of those jurisdictions that have inspectors, those inspectors have things like powers to detain. So if there's a situation on the bus, they can ask that person to get off the bus and then do what they need to do in situations where those situations do escalate. So the hope is that once we do the study is that we'll have a better idea of what fits for Winnipeg and what we should do going forward here.
And right now, those supervisors, just to be clear, those supervisors do not have the right to detain as it is right now.
That's correct.
Okay, but yeah. That could possibly come from this.
Well, potentially. So, I mean, there was that split decision from the Trans Advisory Committee. Like, not everyone's comfortable with that direction. And we really want to be able to really study this in detail to see what would be the appropriate delivery for Winnipeg. Some have called for police force, some want to see an expansion of the inspector force, and some people even don't think it's really that appropriate to have that sort of level of security on buses. So we need to get more information. We need to find out what six other major Canadian cities are doing, and hoping that there's going to be a qualified candidate that's going to bid on this opportunity to be able to advise the city on how we should go forward on this.
What are some of the other cities in Canada doing?
Well, I'm thinking of my trip to, I've been to Toronto, and when I was in Toronto, I think they have inspectors there, and they have something there which is proof of payment. So when you go on a Toronto bus, the fare box isn't up to the bus driver to regulate anymore. In Toronto, if you don't pay your fare, you have a chance of a fine, and that fine is levied by an inspector. So that's one example. In Vancouver, they've got transit police, which is, I understand, funded by the province. If you look to the U.S. In New York, and I know I'm getting out of Canada, but New York, they had some significant issues with their transit. And they actually created a full-fledged police force, but specifically for transit. And Ottawa has done the same thing. So there is quite a range of different different implementations of security on buses. But one thing is there is one trend, I think, in major cities, and that's that there is a desire to have greater security on transit generally than the general police force is able to provide in all those major cities. So those major cities tend to bring in an additional force because there's specific issues in terms of transit. And for anybody who uses transit, drivers and members of the public, I think everyone wants to know that they're safe on buses.
So you mentioned a couple things there, and I want to ask you, is this about security, or is it about making sure people pay their fares when they get on the bus, or both?
Yeah, I'm ad-libbing a bit. The fare piece is that's my own narrative. I know that I heard from the Amalgamated Transit Union over the years that one of the major sources of conflict between drivers and certain members of the public is that fare box. But this is more of a general study to look at more security in general. It's not looking at fares.
And what about public consultation? Will Winnipeggers get a chance to weigh in?
Well, so the scope of the, I mean, with city politics, everyone has a chance to weigh in all the time. Our committee process is very open, and so in terms of this report will be made public. It will be debated. There'll be feedback from the Trans Advisory Committee. There's no specific consultation with the public as part of this RFP. The list of stakeholders to be consulted would be the Winnipeg Police Service, Winnipeg Police Association, the Winnipeg Association of Public Service Officers, and the province of Manitoba, because ultimately if there were certain implementations or certain forces might need new powers from the province of Manitoba to be granted to them.
And you mentioned that the committee was torn on this. It was a split vote, I think, was the language you used. What are the concerns from the people not happy about this RFP?
Yeah, okay, so that's the decision was split when we decided to hire additional point inspectors. So that's something that happened over a year ago.
Right, okay.
In terms of this RFP, it did receive unanimous support from the people at the table. So this is just the first step, and the next step would be actually, there's actually get the qualified candidate to write the study. And then once we have a report, that will be debated, I'm sure.
Any idea on cost, or is that way too soon for that?
Well, the cost for the study is up to $100,000. That's in the public RFP document.
Yep.
But in terms of additional costs,
yeah.
It could be a very wide range of things considered. There could be a very wide range. I don't know that I should be putting numbers to it because I don't have the information.
Yeah, and it depends what is decided, I suppose. I will ask one other thing, and then I'll let you go, Matt. If these inspectors end up getting the right or the ability to detain somebody if there's an issue, that sort of goes against every other thing we've seen in Winnipeg and Manitoba when it comes to security and when there are issues. We usually see the old, do nothing, let them, hands-off approach, whereas it sounds here like maybe there might be a hands-on approach.
Well, I think if we do go in the direction of inspectors with more power, one of the things that is going to be necessary is proper training for those officers. And I've had a bit of experience now talking to people who are involved in training of security officers, and I think with that training, that hands-on is really, I think, a last resort, and you want to do everything you can before getting to that point. I think there are situations where, one of the inspectors I talked to said that maybe once or twice in his career, he's needed that power and he hasn't had it. And so I think it's already something that, I think it's something that would have to be, that would have to come with training. And with that training, the security officials would know when it's appropriate or not.
Matt, thanks a lot for your time. I had a thought, too, before I let you go here. Maybe get the rest of council together, Mayor Bowman, too. All of you throw $5 in, go and get some Lotto Max tickets, and who knows?
that's a great idea, Hal.
Huh? Maybe that's one thing all of you at City Hall can agree on, buying a ticket for the draw tonight.
Yeah, well, I'll see where that goes. But it's a great prize, and that's a great suggestion, too.
Matt, thanks a lot.
Yeah, thank you.
Matt Allard, he is the councillor for St. Boniface. He chairs this transit committee, and there is an RFP now, a request for proposals for transit security. Just after the 2:30 news, and so Dr. Cyrus Dirksen is here with so much paper spread around in front of him. Usually work off an iPad. What's going on?
Well, I wasn't in work, so my little iPad pen is not charged, so I'm back to markers and paper here.
You mean you came in today, you're not even at work, you're not working today, and you came in just for me?
I just love your company.
Isn't that great? That's fantastic. Actually, one of the subjects we're going to talk about today has to do with money, but before we get into that, can I ask you your opinion on the big $70 million Lotto Max jackpot tonight? Biggest ever. Everybody's talking about it. Everybody's buying tickets. What do you make of, here's what interests me about this. When it starts getting up there, the number starts getting bigger. That's when I get interested. And I go and even we've had people, lottery officials on, say that. Say that's why they, keep bumping it up to a bigger number because it gets people buying more tickets. People get excited. What is that all about? Like, what is...
I wish I knew. I should look it up because I noticed the same thing, and really it doesn't make any logical sense. I mean...
Because your chances are less.
Your chances are less, and you'd think that maybe 10 million is enough, so you should be going when it's lower.
Right.
And going out and doing that, you know, it's an interesting phenomenon. We should talk about it more. I think, I bet you there's an interesting, kind of odd psychological principle, but I have to say I don't know what it is.
I guess we hope to win. We daydream about trips and the things we would love to do if we had more money. I guess that's what it's all about, right?
It's like that, just that attention that it gets when it's bigger, right? You know, when people can dream again and they're surprised by how big it is now, and people do love to dream. We actually don't live all that much in our reality. We function better when we live in alternative realities, and the alternative realities can be good or bad. And if we can make good alternative realities like the lotto and things like that, we usually function somewhat better. I wouldn't argue that the lotto is the best alternative reality to live in. It's usually better to live in one that's a little bit more realistic, but it's better than sometimes what's actually going on in people's lives. So there you go. You know, it may be good, might be better, but there's probably something out there that's even better than dreaming about the lotto.
Yeah. And I talked to Carolyn about this yesterday. Carolyn Klassen was in yesterday from Connexus Counseling. And I like to talk to her and you about this kind of stuff. We also had a conversation yesterday about people that win all this money and then they blow it.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
Like it's she said joy is one of the hardest emotions to deal with. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if it's not like when you are in a great relationship or you're with somebody you don't feel you deserve. Some people have that, you know. Me, I deserve it and more. That's how I am. I'm kidding. But, you know, when we don't deserve it, we maybe sabotage it. Maybe that's what these people win all these millions and they blow it.
You know, I've never seen a theory on it, so I've created my own because it's an interesting principle about people's finances and how people who are in debt continue to be in debt. People who have money continue to have money. Even with varying circumstances, people who have money will go through really bad things, lose a lot, and still bounce back and get to that number again. And I believe now, after watching this for some time, that there is a psychological amount that everybody feels comfortable at, like a set amount. And when you're below that amount, and the amount can be minus, when you're below that amount, then you become constricted and you start to feel like, oh my goodness, I don't have enough money. But when you're above that amount, you start to feel free and you feel like you can spend. And sometimes these things are stronger or weaker. So if you win the lottery, you're way above your set amount. And so you're more likely then to spend it because it's above your amount. So let's say somebody might have, just to give you an example, somebody might have a minus 10,000 amount. So that means when they have minus 5,000, they're feeling wealthy and they go out and spend more. But when they're at minus 15, they start to feel constricted. They either get worried and they want to get back to minus 10 and they start to do things in their lives to do that. So I find that people will vary a little bit, bumping, you know, up and down, but they come back to their limit. And so what I do when I work with people who want to make money or usually make money, they don't want to lose money. What I do is I try to hide money that that's above their limit. So if somebody's minus 10, I'll say, well, then live at minus 10. It's going to be a bit more expensive, but it's better just to accept that. And then if you're at minus 5, go hide $5,000 to get yourself back to minus 10. And keep hiding that money that gets you above your limit. If your limit is plus 10, plus 20, hide anything above it in some kind of thing that you don't see right away, maybe some investment or some collectible or something that's you don't think about or is hard to liquidate. It's hard to get the money out of it. And you'll just naturally go back to your set point. And it's awkward for somebody who's at minus 5 to start saving money and putting it somewhere else and to go back to minus 10. But hey, if you can't fight that amount, if you can't fight that set limit, it's better to do that then than to wait for that never coming moment when you're actually above zero. So if you look at your own life, see what is your set limit and how are you managing that and see if it's true for you.
Yeah, I think it is. As you were explaining your theory, I like it. As you were explaining, I'm thinking, there are numbers that I feel okay at.
Mm-hmm.
And if they vary too much one way or the other, I either feel really good or I get worried.
And people will hide money. Like oftentimes people can't save, but they don't consider the mortgage their money.
Right.
So in their personal account, they'll stay at like plus 5, let's say. They'll never get above that. And then when they retire, they're like, well, I guess I have to retire on like the house I purchased because that was the money that they were saving because they didn't consider it money. Mm-hmm. But if they had actually remortgaged and put all of that money in their personal account, they would have spent it on something and gotten back down to their limit of or their set amount in their psychology.
Yeah.
Sometimes people can change it over time. I do think people can change it, but that takes a bit of work. And it's usually easier just to become aware of it and find ways to work with it to hide money in your life so that you don't put it in that checking account where all of a sudden it's just going to bounce back. Some people can't hide it. Some people just know where it is.
They sniff it out.
They
eh?
Sniff it out. They can't stop themselves. And then sometimes people even give money to parents or things like that. It's really hard to manage when you are that motivated to go and take money out of collectibles or things like that. That gets more. Then it becomes more addictive, you know. Mm.
Interesting. Okay, here's our first subject. Headline, do your genes influence how much money you earn?
Well,
which
there
is,
you go.
You know, kind of what we're talking about in a sense. So explain this one.
Well, they can now see, well, they've been able to do this for a while, oftentimes through twin studies and things like this. And when they were looking at, to find out how much of a genetic impact there is on different psychological factors, and what they found was that there are genes, 149 different genes that are associated with income. However, they found that they weren't directly related to income. They seem to be the same genes that are responsible for IQ or intelligence. So, there's no like magic gene that's just going to like give you money. There might be something that gives you an ability that helps you with making money, but not as much just kind of directly. And it does seem that income is related to that a little bit. But you know what? It's interesting. There are genes associated with things that you might not really think about, like being a picky eater. Being a picky eater is 78% genetic.
Really?
Yeah. So when you're dealing with a kid, have a little bit of, I mean, you still got to work on it.
Yeah.
I think it is. There's still, you know, some amount
here.
Well,
how do you battle genetics though?
Right.
How do you?
Well, it's not 100% genetics. So you got 22% there that you're working with. There's a lot of people like for example, with schizophrenia, let's say you have a twins and they both have the same genes. One develops schizophrenia. They're identical twins. One develops schizophrenia at 25 or whatever, and the other one doesn't. And it's like, well, their genes are the same. Isn't schizophrenia genetic? Not 100%. So somebody might have something in their environment, some extra stress or something maybe that...
A trigger of some
kind
sort,
of trigger
eh?
That actually triggers that gene and actually develops a serious disorder. There's a virginity component, like with virginity gene, 30% is controlled by genetics. So if you're, I don't know, if you've got... Whenever you lost your virginity, it's not maybe completely as much up to you as you thought. Popularity genes. There's.
By the way, for me, it wasn't up to me at all.
Yeah.
I had no say at all.
Oh, sheesh. 100%. 100%. Ruthless dictator genes. So there are genes. That maybe makes sense. I mean, narcissism is somewhat genetic. So if you've got, what did it say here? It actually labeled the little Hitlers in your office.
But what's interesting about that, though, is that it's varying levels, right?
Yeah, different things, different amounts.
You know what I mean?
Like,
isn't that interesting, eh?
There's some things you'll have more of an opportunity in your environment to control. Now, also realize none of these things are 100% genetic.
Yeah.
So
nothing is 100% genetic.
Oh, you know, like some things, like really physical things, and you know, I mean, there are things that are more 100%, but even identical twins don't look exactly the same. They often look very close, but there's environmental things that happen as they're being born and way their bones move and things like this that do affect them. So it's hard to find something that's 100% genetic. They can get high, but you have some room in your life to make changes to make a better life, which is
good. That is very interesting. I found that one interesting. Here's the next headline. What it's like when your relationship future is unclear. How does that impact us when we don't know where the relationship is going?
There's not a lot of research on people who are separated and rates of getting back together again. And I get that question quite a bit because people are sometimes struggling with whether they should get separated. And it seems 6 to 18% of people who are still married have been separated at one point in their relationship. So they're obviously they came back together and didn't go through with it, didn't get divorced. So there is hope that if you get separated that you might still come back together. Again, although a lot of people who separate will eventually get divorced. And there are some couples, I wouldn't say it happens a lot, but who just chronically live in this ambiguity, on-again, off-again relationship, sometimes for decades. And it can be very challenging to find a way for them to manage that. They just can't pull apart from each other. And I don't know how many people out there have actually gone through something like this, but any kind of ambiguity, even in a relationship, is just very stressful. It's, I don't know if I'm married. You can't make plans. Yeah. You can't plan vacations.
Right.
Can't plan children. You can't figure this stuff out. And so usually there is some kind of time limit for people on, like, they can't mm-hmm. go on. And that's very stressful to actually continue on with.
Is usually the best, and maybe there's not, maybe you can't speak in general terms, but is it usually best, unless somebody obviously is in physical danger or something like that, in a relationship, is it always best to stay together and try and battle through it together? Or are there times where you go, yeah, you guys do need a break?
You know, I personally, in my practice, yeah. I don't recommend divorce. Ever. That doesn't mean that people shouldn't get divorced, I guess. Like, these are decisions. I don't make that decision for people.
Yeah,
so
right.
if somebody came to my practice and they're like, should I get divorced? I'll say, that's not a fair question for me to answer.
Yeah.
So the closest I come to is recommending separation, which I see is quite different from divorce. Separation, although it can sometimes contribute to
lead
an eventual,
to that, yeah.
yeah, it can eventually lead to that. It's quite different. And people will often look at divorce or separation. Sometimes they don't even consider separation. They just think go straight
yeah,
to...
Yeah, it's done. It's over.
It's done. It's very,
I think part of that yeah. is we live in this real disposable society, right?
Yeah.
We throw everything away.
Yeah, definitely. And even in separations, people are very black and white in their thinking. So oftentimes what I'm talking about with people is, how do you want to separate? Do you want to separate in the same house? Do you want to separate sexually, emotionally, parentally, all of them in the same house, separate houses? Like, there's a lot of gray even in how you do a separation. And I find that some form of separation, and people often come in and they're somewhat separated already.
Yeah.
They're not feeling as close to each other.
If they're coming to see you, chances are it's already pretty far down the road.
There's some kind of emotional separation for sure. And what I'm often telling people, this is what I believe, is that if you can make your physical relationship and emotional relationship look the same, if you can line those up. So if you feel really like you hate the other person and you're still living in the same house, it's very stressful. And if you can make your physical relationship look the same as your emotional relationship, it actually reduces stress, which is tricky because sometimes...
And then you can sort of see the issue better, right?
Yeah, hopefully we want to reduce
less cloud.
What can sometimes happen, and this is very dangerous, is therapists will sometimes recommend divorce. Because people will come back and say, oh, I'm so thankful. Because what the couple did was they divorced, the stress went down because now their physical relationship resembles their emotions, and they think that they made the right decision. And I don't want to say they didn't, but I think therapists can sometimes make some hay off of happy clients who have divorced, who maybe could have made their relationship work, now have to struggle with some of these effects of divorce in their children and later in life, and actually having come together... may have been beneficial in the end or possible. And so I think we have to be careful about recommending divorce because there is that false lowering stress that happens when you get away from somebody you're having a conflict with when still there's a possibility of getting back together.
Hal Anderson Afternoons, the podcast, is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and anywhere you find your favorite podcasts.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone, like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.